Let me open with a word of prayer. Dear Lord, our Heavenly Father, you are heavenly. You are the creator of heaven and earth. You are the ultimate lawgiver. And we rejoice in renewed minds to be able to understand that there is true liberty found within your laws. We thank you for your goodness to us and your grace. We pray, dear Lord, that your Spirit would move, grant us understanding of citizenship even further, rebuild our ruins, restore our race. For your glory and our good, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, in this course on America and Western civilization, we have said that we're going to travel through several cities, Jerusalem, and then through Athens, and then Rome, and then London to America. It's the same trip that Russell Kirk took in The Roots of the American Order in his book. But as a Baptist and an evangelical Christian, my approach to Jerusalem is a bit different than his. We have gone through and looked at various aspects of Israel. We found that there is human equality on creation. God created us in his image, male and female. That there's true liberty found in his law. That we are to proclaim liberty throughout the land, as Israel did, Leviticus 25:10. God's law is the law of liberty, James 1:25. We saw that in Israel, it's no question that they were subjects. God was their king, and it wasn't until 1 Samuel chapter 8, where the Israelites rejected God as their king and wanted a human king, just like the nations around them. They were subjects of God the king. And yet, they had many characteristics of citizens that we looked at through our travel through Jerusalem, through the Mosaic Law. Not just on equality, not just on liberty, which historically in Western civilization society is grounded on, but also private property rights. Citizens are a self-sufficient community. They manage their own farms and businesses. They believe in personal responsibility, that citizens take responsibility for their actions. This is all within Israel, within their defined boundaries. You do not have a nation without boundaries, and you don't have citizens of a nation without boundaries. As subjects of God the King, they owed allegiance to God, as we've seen. And yet as citizens, they gave their express consent to God's authority. In Exodus chapter 24, they said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. And that each generation was to renew the covenant, their allegiance. In the second giving of the law, we saw that in the book of Deuteronomy. There was the implied right of expatriation, which is a part of citizenship, where Naomi, for instance, and her husband left Israel for a period of time. Dual citizenship in Israel was not permitted. They were banned from making treaties with foreign nations. They must have sole allegiance to the nation, to God. And mixed marriages were prohibited with the pagans. Marriage in Israel was the primary way in which immigration took place. And as we saw at the end of Nehemiah, Nehemiah was so angry that they had married pagans, but he was also angry that the children of those mixed marriages could not speak Hebrew. that to have a nation, you need a single language. And as we saw in Philippians chapter 3, verse 20, where our citizenship is in heaven, the Greek word for citizenship can be translated conversation. As citizens, we have a conversation about fundamental values. And you can't have a conversation if you don't speak the same language. As the Tower of Babel illustrated in Genesis that we pondered as well, different languages divide. But all of these factors make citizenship flourish in ancient Israel. And this is why we would say they were both subjects and citizens in ancient Israel. And why I believe then that Western civilization began in Israel. This is a review that I put on the board. So this is a tight summary of about whatever we spent, hour and a half, 2 hours last time we met. But this is a short summary on one side of the board here of all that we had covered, that Israelites were both subjects and citizens, that God is the only perfect king with no abuse of man's God-given rights. And that's what God was warning them through Samuel in 1 Samuel chapter 8 to say, hey, you want an earthly king? Well, guess what? It's going to become a burden upon you. That's what happens with human monarchs. And the whole history of the Israelites showed that human kings doesn't work out very well when they're depraved in Adam. That God himself is the only good king. Which is why then at the American founding period, the view among the founders was that when you put all the powers of the legislative power, the lawmaking power, the judiciary power of interpreting the law, and the executive power of executing the laws, all in one person, if all those powers are in one human being who's a fallen human being, a sinful human being, that's the very definition of tyranny, according to the American founders. And the whole history of the world has shown that. Well, James I, we looked at, he was king of Great Britain. He liked to call himself king of Great Britain, where both Scotland and England, he was king from 1603 to 1625. He believed in the divine right of kings. We discussed a little bit of that, where he, in a sense, then was claiming no accountability to other earthly authorities. That's the essence of the divine right of kings. He's trying to say that God granted him authority as a civil government ruler, as the monarch, and no other earthly authority is he accountable to. Now, we went through and just briefly mentioned all of the various charters and constitutions and Bill of Rights and other things that were declared in the history of England in the battle between the people and their representatives in Parliament and the King of England. The big debate is how much allegiance did the citizenry owe to the king? And we looked a little bit at Calvin's case, 1608. Sir Edward Coke for the King's Court issued the opinion. And the central idea was that anyone born in the king's realm is a subject or a citizen by birth and owes permanent allegiance to the king. And then one needs the king's permission to leave. There was no right of expatriation. Again, you remember this was this case where this young boy, this baby, Calvin, was born in Scotland and yet was entitled to land by inheritance in England, but other men claimed the land, and then the dispute was, okay, does he have a right to that land? Well, only if he is a subject of King James I, who's over both areas, not just Scotland, but also England. So this was the holding in the case, basically, but it gave this central idea of birthright subjection, that you're a subject by birth of the king if you're born anywhere in the king's realm. and your permanent allegiance. You can never leave unless the king grants you permission. Well, England's or Great Britain's history involved then conflict between Parliament and the king and queen. Great conflict, whether it's the Charter of Liberties from 1100 AD, the Constitutions of Clarendon 1164 AD, the Magna Carta 1215 AD, Confirmatio Carterum 1297 AD, the Petition of Rights 1628 AD, the English Bill of Rights 1689 AD. But this great battle between Parliament, the people's representatives, and the king, to say that the king is accountable to earthly authorities, that is Parliament. That's the great battle within England. They had a mixed republic in a certain sense, because they had a monarchy that was unelected, and yet they had an elected Parliament. The word parliamentum was first used in 1254 AD, just 40 years after the Magna Carta, basically. Magna Carta was 1215. Where the barons, basically, at knife point, helped King John to sign the Magna Carta, declaring their rights as Englishmen. Basically, their right not to be taxed without their representation, due process rights, and other rights. So that's this great conflict. But this is this first sense where it's first in a court case saying you're a subject by birth. Or in that case, a citizen as well, by birth. The Pilgrims settled America at Plymouth Rock in 1620. We looked at that 12 years after the Calvin's case. Now, you remember the storm blew them north. They were supposed to end up around Virginia, but they ended up in present-day Massachusetts at Plymouth Rock. There was no government there. So before they got off the ship, they wrote the Mayflower Compact. And it was a covenant. It says explicitly in it, it's a covenant before God. As I mentioned on our Thanksgiving evening service, they started with the line, "In the name of God, amen." This is the way it starts. But they're committed to the common good. They express citizenship as well. They express that they're subjects of King James I. So they're both subjects and citizens. Citizens are those who are committed to the common good. And that's what they were doing in the Mayflower Compact, which is a covenant along the lines of Israel, covenanting before God to form a civil government. As I mentioned, America is a land of immigrants. So English colonists in America in the 1600s and 1700s were moving to a view of citizenship by voluntary consent rather than natural birth. It's real interesting. You try and find an academic book on, I've got one that was from a scholar, I believe, out of Southern California from the 1970s. There's hardly anything out there. It's about the only one that looks at from the early founding of America up through the 1800s, the whole history of citizenship and the development of it. And it looks at stages of the development of it. But they were moving, since we're a whole land of immigrants, you're here by voluntary consent. You got on a ship, went across the Atlantic. You're here by voluntary consent, which then moves to this idea that you're more of a citizen than a subject. And you're a part of America as a citizen by voluntary consent, not by birth. Okay, so that's what everything was forming and moving toward. In 1776, Americans exercised their right of expatriation. Now remember up here, Calvin's case, Sir Edward Cook, he said you're born a subject of the king, if you're born anywhere in the king's realm, and you need the king's permission to leave. Well, what did they do here? In 1776, did they ask permission? King George? No, they didn't, did they? In other words, they're saying, we're citizens and we have the right of expatriation if we so choose. We don't have to ask for your permission. You violated our God-given rights as laid out in the Declaration of Independence after a long train of abuses, which was the whole point I mentioned with Sir Edward Cook in the Calvin's case He said this was grounded in the laws of nature. Right. Laws of nature, and nature is God. But that says that the king is under God and must secure our God-given rights. So then what happens if the king keeps violating our God-given rights? By this time, it's King George. Well, exercise the right of expatriation through the civil magistrates. They didn't ask for the king's permission as subjects by birth. To say that civil governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed does not mean the people, by their consent, make just whatever laws they want. I have to stress that because some people get bent out of shape over that language. They derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. That's right. God is over all. All authority is from God. There is no human authority except from God, Romans 13:1, that we've looked at. But the question is, what form of government are you going to form, right? We've looked at, there's monarchy, there's aristocracy, there's democracy, and there's a republic, a mix of all three in some way or another, right? That's this idea of just powers. How are you going to put it out there with who has what? The legislative power, judiciary, executive, how are you going to have checks and balances? All of that stuff. Are you going to have a unicameral legislature or a bicameral legislature, right? What is it? Nebraska has a unicameral legislature. They don't have a Senate and a House. They just got one branch, right? But it's still a Republican form of government. God's laws still govern, but the question is, what powers are you going to grant to the government and how are you going to disperse them to try and secure your God-given rights? Well, the 13 states, the newly formed states, formed a League of Friendship, as we said, in the Articles of Confederation. 1781 to 1789 became effective because of the war. Didn't really end until 1776 to 1783 was the War for Independence, but it was first articulated 1781, and it was effective really 1783 to 1789, but it didn't do a good job. It did not have enough powers to secure their God-given rights. As we said, it didn't have an executive. There's no executive branch. Didn't have a judiciary in their Articles of Confederation, no federal judiciary. Didn't have the power. You say, well, what powers are you going to give it? Right? Didn't have the powers to regulate commerce between the states. Didn't have the power to directly tax anyone. They just had to ask for permission to requisitions. Please pay if you're willing. Well, it's hard to have a government, right, if you can't force taxation. Couldn't coin money, so then the states could manipulate the money, but they had no control over the value of the currency. So there was problems. A big recession took place under the Articles of Confederation, which is why then they got together to, in a sense, amend them or rewrite them, but they ended up writing the U.S. Constitution in the summer from May to September of 1787, which became effective and ratified 1789. But just powers are those that effectively secure man's God-given rights. And that's what we have in the U.S. Constitution, is they're trying to say these powers were granted under the Articles of Confederation aren't really just. They're struggling to secure our God-given rights. They're too weak in the League of Friendship between the 13 states, so therefore we need the U.S. Constitution to grant more effective powers, more just powers to the central government to secure our God-given rights, but in a way that doesn't, we don't want it to become a Leviathan again. We just fought a war with Great Britain. We don't want it to violate our God-given rights. Which hopefully then, once we get to America, we'll ponder more of that. But that's where you have this battle between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. And the Anti-Federalists were the ones that demanded a Bill of Rights be added to the U.S. Constitution. Say, we can't trust the federal government. We're going to give them too many powers, and we need a Bill of Rights to ensure that they restrain themselves. Well, it's important to note, as I said, the Declaration of Independence does not demand any form of government. It just says that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it's the right of the people to either alter or abolish it and to establish a new government. Whatever form you want. It didn't say it had to be a Republican form of government. It could have been another monarchy with a different form of parliament. with some checks and balances. It could have been all sorts. But whatever form you want, you can form it. This was real interesting. So the Declaration of Independence does not demand any form of government, whether it be democracy, aristocracy, monarchy, or a republic, a mixture of all three. But the U.S. Constitution requires of any states that are added to the Union, started with 13 states, right? Now we got 50. Well, of each state that's added to the Union, in Article 4, Section 4, the U.S. Constitution requires that they be a Republican government. But then there's different forms of Republican government. That's why I said you could have a unicameral legislature like Nebraska, or a bicameral one, like most of the other states. But pick your choice, right? So there's variances. So in other words, those that were involved in drafting the U.S. Constitution did think that a Republican, a mixed form of government, was the best. Now, when we get to Athens, that's where we're going to be looking at one statesman named Solon, the way his reforms that took place in Athens has showed mixing the powers between these various groups of people works real well. That's a review for the last time we met. I was thinking how to handle this, and that's why once we get to some Supreme Court cases, I wrote a little bit on the back of the board, so you'll be able to picture it in your mind a little bit on some Supreme Court cases. Now, from 1789, when the U.S. Constitution was ratified, until the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. So the Bill of Rights are the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Okay, that's the Bill of Rights. Essentially, 1791... they had all these proposals to Madison at the U.S. House, and then they whittled them all down and then voted on them and came down to 10. From there, there was a process in the U.S. Constitution as to how you amend the U.S. Constitution legally. Well, after the Civil War, you remember the Civil War took place 1861 to 1865. We have the Civil War amendments, and one of them is very important. It's the 14th Amendment. It was adopted in 1868. And it has in it a citizenship clause. But before we get into that citizenship clause, it's important to remember the prominence that was given to the states in the early 1800s compared to the federal government. From 1789 to the Civil War, 1861, the beginning of the Civil War, state citizenship determined federal citizenship. State citizenship determined federal citizenship. In other words, those who were determined citizens of the states were automatically deemed citizens of the U.S. government. I mean, think in your mind right now. My nephew Paul is here visiting. He's a citizen of Tennessee. We are citizens here of Minnesota. And yet, Paul and us are both citizens of the United States, correct? Correct. From 1789 to the beginning of the Civil War, 1861, what was predominant was state citizenship. What is predominant nowadays is U.S. citizenship. Okay, just reverse, okay? Before the U.S. Civil War, U.S. soldiers, I remember one biography I read of Robert E. Lee. The soldiers, the U.S. soldiers, before the Civil War, in their Pledge of Allegiance, they pledged allegiance to, quote, these United States. It was plural. Plural. Today we pledge allegiance to the United States, singular. It's a big change that took place. Before the Civil War, state citizenship determined federal citizenship. Robert E. Lee was asked by the North to fight as a general for the North during the Civil War. He was a citizen of Virginia. Your state citizenship was primary. Your U.S. citizenship was secondary. It's the main reason. It wasn't slavery. The main reason for him was, I'm a citizen of Virginia, and I'll fight whatever side Virginia's on. Now, since state citizenship was primary before the Civil War, your allegiance then was primarily to your state, not the United States then. That's another way of saying it. And the states had many requirements for state citizenship. There were oaths of allegiance, common today, right? Have an oath of allegiance. Tests of moral character. And residency requirements. How long you reside in a particular place. Well, there are certain residency requirements, typically how long you need to reside in a given location in order to become a citizen. Now, many of the states, part of that moral character test was a religious test, because many of the states at America's founding had established religions. The U.S. Constitution, as we know, under the First Amendment, we've looked at that. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So there's no religious test for office for the federal government nor for citizenship. But we can have a moral test with, we don't want criminals. We want good moral people to become citizens. We don't want mentally insane people coming here from some foreign country. We don't want criminals coming here from some foreign country. We want them to give an oath of allegiance, of loyalty, and have good moral character and residency requirements, which gives us time to see that you have good moral character. For foreigners that were seeking U.S. citizenship, Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution granted the U.S. Congress the power to, quote, establish a uniform rule of naturalization. A uniform rule of naturalization. We've mentioned it briefly the last time we met, but naturalization refers to the whole process of being granted citizenship. To immigrate here is one thing. You can immigrate here and live here temporarily under a work visa or something else, right? Or just, we're allowing you to immigrate here as a vacationer, whatever, take your trip. But naturalization involves becoming a citizen. And it was under Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution where the founders granted Congress, the U.S. Congress, the authority, the power to make a uniform rule of naturalization. Okay, what rules are we going to have to become citizens? And the nation's first naturalization law was 1790, right away there, and it, quote, required proof that the applicant be a, quote, a person of good character. And they had to, quote, take an oath or affirmation prescribed by law to support the Constitution of the United States. And there was a residency requirement as well at the beginning of 2 years. So they had to be good moral character for the U.S. citizenship, give the oath of allegiance to support the Constitution of the U.S. Its language said this, now listen carefully, that it limited naturalization, quote, to any alien being a free white person who shall have resided, dot, 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 unquote. Of any alien being a free white person. What's important is that we don't read into it our understanding today, into their understanding back then. Okay? It's unfortunate they use that language, because today we'd look at that and say, well, they're racist. The first naturalization law does not allow non-white aliens. To understand correctly what they meant at that time, we have to understand in the world, where was Christianity? In what nations of the world was Christianity in 1790? You remember in the book of Acts, in Acts chapter 16, verses 6 through 10, turn in your Bibles to Acts 16, 6 through 10. This is the Macedonian call. Acts 16, 6 through 10. Let me read this here. Hear now the words of God. Now when they had gone through Phrygia and the region of Galatia, they were forbidden by the Holy Spirit to preach the word in Asia. After they had come to Mysia, they tried to go into Bithynia, but the Holy Spirit did not permit them. So passing by Mysia, they came down to Troas, and a vision appeared to Paul in the night. A man of Macedonia stood and pleaded with him, saying, come over to Macedonia and help us. Now after he had seen the vision, immediately we sought to go to Macedonia, concluding that the Lord had called us to preach the gospel to them. So don't go east, don't go to Asia, go to Europe. Go to Europe. And notice they end up at Philippi. Go down to verse 12. And from there to Philippi is where they ended up. Philippi is Eastern Europe, named after Philip, the father of Alexander the Great. There you're into the ancient Greek city-states, right? And what's real fascinating when we get into the travel through Athens, Lord willing, in the coming classes, Victor Davis Hanson points out at this time, the barbarians, who are barbarians at this time? The blonde-haired, blue-eyed Scandinavians and the Germanic tribes that roamed Western Europe were the barbarians. They weren't civilized. Until the gospel would later come, the civilization was around the Mediterranean. But in God's providence, barbarians in Asia as well, but God wanted the gospel to go to the barbarians in Europe. I happen to have white skin. God's providence. Adoniram Judson took him a long time before he ever got to Burma. That's in God's providence. That was non-European. So the gospel went to Europe. It's the European nations that then became Christian. Those who have white skin. Especially Northern Europe and Western Europe. But the modern missionary movement to non-Europeans, those who do not have white skin, did not really begin until the 1700s. There was some during the 1700s, but not really until William Carey and the Baptist Missionary Society in 1792. First naturalization law was 1790 in the U.S. So in 1790, most of the world without white skin was unreached with the gospel of Christ. Thomas G. West notes this, quote, the authors of the 1790 Act, the first naturalization law, were obviously using the word white as a rough equivalent of European. In contrast to blacks and Indians, Europe was the realm of what we now call Western civilization, unquote. Or as what we also would call it, as we've said in our course, Christendom, where there's the formal recognition of the lordship of Jesus Christ over all things. Where was that? Well, these white-skinned people in Europe, right? Now, remember, at the very beginning of this course, at the introduction, I said, the class is America and Western Civilization. What is civilization? A civilization are the cultural characteristics of a people group. The cultural characteristics of a people group. Well, what's the culture? That depends on the cult. The cult, as we said, is from the Latin and French cultus and culte, which means the general overall religious worship and devotion of a people group. The cultus and culte is the general overall religious devotion and worship of a people group. That determines its culture, which then shapes its ethics of what they think is right and wrong, which then shapes its laws for society, and then how it functions then as a nation. So if you want people to immigrate here, and you're a part of Western civilization, Christendom, where do you want your immigrants to come from? If you're concerned with preserving your culture, you want them to come from nations that formally recognize the lordship of Jesus Christ, right? Which at that time was white-skinned people of Europe. What they meant was people who have come from Christian nations. They might not all be Christians, but guess what? They're raised that way with this whole mindset and custom of Christianity around the Ten Commandments, around the liberties that we see from the Bible. So focusing on the overall religious devotion and worship of the immigrants allows you then to maintain your culture. If you're not focused on that, you will not maintain your culture as a nation. Thomas G. West, he continued, this is another thing he said, quote, Europeans as a group shared with Americans a heritage of morality, religion, and respect for reason that made them, in the founders' view, the most likely candidates for successful assimilation into democratic citizenship. In those days, Christianity was mostly limited to Europeans, and most Europeans were Christians. In the founding era and through most of the American history, Christianity was widely regarded as the best religious foundation for free institutions. Unquote. For morality, religion, and respect for reason. You don't find respect for reason, human reason, in Buddhism or Hinduism. You don't. And in some forms of Islam, you don't either. Aquinas was dealing with that in his day. Irrational Islamists. To be able to have the conversation of citizens that believe in absolutes and the law of non-contradiction around morality grounded in the Bible and God's Word, right? In the Christian religion. It's just unfortunate they use the word white rather than just plain saying Christian. Yet, in America, because, as we've covered, because we're Baptists, right? Because of the influence of Roger Williams and the Quakers, happen to join him in his view, but because of Roger Williams, for U.S. citizenship in America, a Christian denomination cannot be a condition to say you must be Presbyterian, Congregational, or Episcopalian, or Baptist, no. Right? We've looked at that, right? Because of Romans 13, 1 through 10, Roger Williams said the first table of the Ten Commandments dealing with our relationship with God should not be criminalized. The only examples of commandments given in Romans 13, 1 through 10, and Romans 13, 9 are examples from the second table of the Ten Commandments. Those are the only sins that should be criminalized in a Gentile government and allow religious freedom and free exercise of religion under the first table. We've looked at that. And that's the way the first naturalization law functioned. We want people, by and large, from a Christian heritage, from nations that are Christian. Yet, a Christian denomination cannot be a condition. And that's the way they designed the first naturalization law. Because we want to maintain the cult. And we're going to see the importance of the cult once we get to the ancient Greek city-states, once we get to Athens, and why they always failed with their paganism, and why we're on the cusp of failing today with the neo-pagan revolution from the 1960s. Now, that first naturalization law had 2 years, as I said, 2 year residency requirement. Well, we've talked about this before. The very bloody French Revolution. We said at the very beginning in the intro to this course, secularism dominated for 200 years, 1789 to 1989. Basically, the beginning of the French Revolution to the fall of the Soviet Union. It's where Peter Jones puts it as the peak of secularism in the world. So you can imagine the Christians in America that founded America, our founding fathers were overall Christians, by and large. Well, you've got human reason, as we said, being paraded through Notre Dame as a goddess. Say, the French Revolution was about pure secularism, this world is all there is, they worshipped human reason. Well, we don't want them coming to America very easily, right? All these crazies from France. So they raised the residency requirement to 14 years, from 2 years to 14 years, real quickly in the 1790s, in their naturalization law. And literally, they said they'd have habits of character that would not fit well with the, quote, free citizens of America. Habits of character. And there again, you're concerned with what? Civilization. Maintaining civilization. So who you bring in is important. That's why the Israelites, under God's law, mixed marriages with pagans was banned. That's how you bring in the pagans to become citizens of your country and intermingle and end up with children that are pagans. You change the cult that way, the culture. And you've got to prevent it. Just keep in your mind, this is interesting, the founders of this country, so in Article 1, Section 8, they granted the U.S. Congress the power to pass uniform law on naturalization. Didn't say anything about immigration. They didn't pass a federal immigration law until 1881. I think it was signed into law 1882. First federal immigration law. That's where you're just trying to regulate who comes here as a resident. Naturalization is saying, okay, who gets to become a citizen? So the Constitution, the founders of this country, indirectly regulated immigration for 90 years through naturalization rules. You see that, as I just mentioned, from the first naturalization law having 2 years residency to become a citizen. And then when the French Revolution was going on, oh, these people have terrible character. They worship the goddess of reason. We don't want them to come here as citizens. Let's raise the residency requirement to 14 years. So the idea is if your foreigner looks and says, well, to become a citizen in America, it takes 14 years. You got to live there. And you don't get the rights and privileges of a citizen until after 14 years go by. Why do I want to move there? So the idea is you're indirectly regulating immigration through naturalization. That's the way we functioned for 90 years then, from 1790 to basically 1882. Okay? After the Civil War, so we had the Civil War, 1861 to 1865, 660,000 Americans died. The time came then to clarify the citizenship of the free African-American slaves. They'd been freed. So we have to clarify citizenship for them, right? So we have the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution after the Civil War. 14th Amendment after the Civil War was ratified 1868, and it had a citizenship clause in it. It has a clause in there on equal protection. It has a clause related with due process. But there's an important clause on the citizenship. So you have to deal with these freed African American slaves. Okay, we've got to make sure, how do we deal with them with citizenship? Well, I put the quote here, okay, so you have it. Quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside, unquote. I'll read it again. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. You can kind of see it when you look at it. This is where U.S. citizenship was made primary. This is where U.S. citizenship was made primary, and state citizenship is a derivative of it. So then you're making sure that the southern states cannot keep freed African Americans from being citizens. So if one is a citizen of the United States, then they're by law also a citizen of the state in which they reside. It was impossible for the southern states then to prevent newly freed slaves from becoming U.S. citizens. Remember, early 1800s, it was primarily state citizenship that determined federal citizenship. And this is where it's flipped on its head. Ever since then, what do? We pledge allegiance to the United States. And our citizenship to the United States government is primary. And our citizenship to the state in which we reside is secondary. But this language here in the citizenship clause gave rise to some serious questions about American Indians and birthright citizenship. What about Native American Indians who have been born here, who reside in Indian tribes? How do we look at this with regard to birthright citizenship? Well, U.S. senators, at the time, U.S. senators, that this 14th Amendment, when it was written and ratified, U.S. senators had the answers. Okay? It's referred to as legislative intent. We go back to say, okay, what did they mean? 14th Amendment, this is supreme law of the land, part of the Constitution, and it amended the U.S. Constitution under the Supremacy Clause. In our human laws, in our nation, the U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land. A part of originalism is to say, okay, what with the words that they used, what meaning is tied to those words at the time it was written and ratified? And you say, well, what did they intend when they used these words and ratified it? What did they intend? That meaning is tied to that. Listen here to U.S. Senator Jacob Howard of Ohio. U.S. Senator Jacob Howard of Ohio. He said this, quote, Indians born within the limits of the United States and who maintain their tribal relations are not, in the sense of this amendment, born subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Unquote. Say it again. This is U.S. Senator Jacob Howard of Ohio at the time the 14th Amendment was written and ratified. Quote, Indians, Native American Indians, born within the limits of the United States and who maintain their tribal relations, loyalties to their Indian tribes, are not, in the sense of this 14th Amendment, born subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, unquote. I put on the board here U.S. Senator Lyman Trumbull. He was chairman of the Senate U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee at the time the 14th Amendment was written and ratified. He said, that subject to the jurisdiction thereof, this clause here, because you notice it says, I'll read it again, the 14th Amendment Citizenship Clause. All persons born or naturalized in the United States, so either you've gone through the naturalization process under federal law or you're born here. That's the first condition. And subject to the jurisdiction thereof. That's the second condition. That's the question is, what does the second condition mean? Here's what he says. U.S. Senator Lyman Trumbull, the chairman of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee at that time, quote, subject to the jurisdiction thereof simply meant, quote, not owing allegiance to anybody else, subject to the complete jurisdiction of the United States, unquote. I'll say it again. Subject to the jurisdiction thereof simply meant not owing allegiance to anybody else, subject to the complete jurisdiction of the United States, unquote. These Native American Indians living on their with their Indian tribes, they owed allegiance to their Indian tribes, even if it was just partial. And what is being required under the 14th Amendment is you either, the first condition, you have to be born here or naturalized here following the laws of naturalization, and you have to have complete allegiance and loyalty to the jurisdiction of the United States. Jurisdiction in Latin, juris, law, diction, to speak. Literally, the authority to speak the law. That you have complete loyalty to the authority of the Constitution of the United States. One scholar, contemporary in our day, Edward Erler, interesting, this man, Edward Erler, had conversation with President Trump during his first term. Here's what he said, Erler. Thus, two requirements were set for U.S. citizenship, born or naturalized in the United States and subject to its jurisdiction. Birth within the territorial limits of the United States, as the case of the Indians seems to indicate, did not make them automatically subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Native American Indians were born here, but that alone did not automatically make them citizens of the United States. Why? Because they still had allegiance, if just partial allegiance, to their own Indian tribes. A separate nation. The U.S. senators at that time used the term jurisdiction instead of allegiance. You notice that, right? The second condition is, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. They used the term jurisdiction for allegiance. And what was the reason? It was to avoid any misunderstanding with the common law doctrine established in Calvin's case in 1608. To avoid any connection to Calvin's case, which talked about allegiance, that one there in 1608, anyone born within the king's realm owed permanent and perpetual allegiance to the king and could never leave unless the king granted permission. But they used the word in the 14th Amendment, jurisdiction instead of allegiance, to make sure you don't have in your mind the common law doctrine of Calvin's case. Birth alone will not suffice, and they wanted to make that clear, in other words. Calvin's case was saying birth and birth alone established subjectship, citizenship. For U.S. citizenship, the applicant must fulfill not only the conditions of birth or naturalization, but also give sole, complete allegiance and loyalty to the United States of America, to be subject to the jurisdiction thereof. This means, then, for the founders, dual citizenship should not be permitted. I remember working when I was in the U.S. Forest Service in Alaska. I worked with a guy that had dual citizenship. He was a citizen of Canada and the United States. His loyalties were divided. But for the founders and for the U.S. senators, following the U.S. founders of the U.S. Constitution, dual citizenship should not be permitted. One of the requirements is sole and complete allegiance and loyalty to the United States of America. And that birth alone will not suffice. As Senator Howard noted, at the time the phrase, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, means that citizenship in the U.S., quote, will not, of course, include persons born in the United States who are foreigners, aliens who belong to the families of ambassadors or foreign ministers, unquote. That's also well, Senator Howard at that time of Ohio. So you have foreigners of foreign nations coming to visit us. Maybe they come with their pregnant wives. Maybe they're living at the consulates, right? They have certain embassies, and they have pregnant wives, and they're having children. But any foreigner, any alien, anyone belonging to ambassadors, foreign ministers, but they have children that are born here, that alone will not make them a citizen. Same situation like the Native American Indians. Now, the Native American Indians, who wanted to give their complete allegiance to the United States of America and were born here and followed the naturalization rules, yes, they could become citizens. Many of them did. But if you want to maintain and live in a teepee in your own tribe and have partial loyalty to that, you cannot become a citizen of the United States. That's what was laid out and established. What's interesting to me, when you ponder the two conditions, and you think about us, many of us who were born here, each generation born in the United States must renew their sole allegiance to the country, as each generation of the Israelites were expected to renew their covenant allegiance. The second giving of the law in Deuteronomy. They also covenanted and renewed the covenant personally. So there's a certain sense that each of us then, in order once we get to the age of voting and all the rest, we who are born here should also be expected to publicly, at a ceremony, pass a citizenship test and give sole allegiance to the United States of America in order to be citizens. If you follow the logic of it, right? Birth alone will not suffice, which is the way we've been treating it. Now I'm going to have more to say on that at the very end, about Vivek Ramaswamy's proposal. Now, as we've said, when the founders of the United States of America declared independence from Great Britain, they exercised the right of expatriation. They declared independence without the king's permission. They expatriated themselves from Great Britain. Right? The opening paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, that when in the course of human events it becomes necessary to separate the political bonds which have connected you to another and to assume among the powers of the earth this separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitled you. They separated the political bonds. They expatriated themselves from King George without his permission, right? Well, because they were rejecting birthright citizenship, that they owed perpetual permanent allegiance to the king by birth. They rejected that. That was in Calvin's case. The Declaration of Independence is a declaration of that in itself, that they rejected Sir Edward Coke in Calvin's case, saying we're expatriating of our own will. Well, what would you expect then in 1868 when they pass the 14th Amendment? Well, they also passed the Federal Expatriation Act of 1868. Logically consistent with the view that you're here by consent and you get to leave by consent. So, you're voluntarily here by consent. When do you want to leave? You want to stay? You want to leave? It's up to you. You want to become a citizen of Mexico? Some of them right now don't like Trump. They leave and become a citizen of Mexico. Okay, go for it. You're here by consent? You leave by consent. And that's what Congress passed, the Expatriation Act of 1868. Now listen to this. U.S. Representative Friedrich Woodbridge of Vermont, U.S. Representative in Congress, Friedrich Woodbridge of Vermont, he argued this with regard to the Expatriation Act of 1868, quote, "The old feudal doctrine stated by Blackstone and adopted as part of the common law of England," that Sir Edward Coke in Calvin's case was a part of the common law of England, it was part of Sir William Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England. Now remember, we didn't take everything from the common law here, like the laws of primogeniture. Paul's the oldest son in his family. That doesn't mean he gets to inherit everything of his father. Okay? We reject the primogeniture laws that the oldest son gets everything or most things. No. Okay? We don't have that in the United States that the common law had that gave preference to the oldest son. So we didn't take everything from the English common law, even though we did take a lot. I told you that every lawyer in the land right now, when I took the bar exam, almost 25 years ago now, part of the bar exam is on the common law. Every state in our union has the English common law part of it, except for Louisiana, which has its French history. But it deals with all sorts of things with property law and with tort law, contract law, and all sorts of areas of law. And English common law we inherited from England, but that doesn't mean we accepted everything from England. Primogeniture laws we didn't. We did not accept Calvin's case. Birthright citizenship. We rejected that as well. But this is what he said, okay, U.S. Representative Friedrich Woodbridge of Vermont. "The old feudal doctrine stated by Blackstone and adopted as part of the common law of England that once a citizen by the accident of birth, expatriation under any circumstance less than the consent of the sovereign is an impossibility." Meaning if you're born under the king's realm, you owe permanent perpetual allegiance and you cannot leave unless the king grants permission. That is the old feudal doctrine, lord-vassal relationship under the common law. That was put in Calvin's case by Sir Edward Coke, right? He says, this U.S. Representative Friedrich Woodbridge, "The doctrine is not only at war with the theory of our institutions, but is equally at war with every principle of justice and of sound public law." Anyone who accepts birthright citizenship is at war with our founding principles. That's how serious this is. Their clear intent of the founders, the clear intent of those who wrote and ratified the 14th Amendment in 1868 and passed the Federal Act of Expatriation in 1868, their clear intent was to banish the idea of birthright citizenship from America. That birth alone within U.S. borders will not make one a citizen. And that's what Edward Erler was talking to Trump about in his first term. Trump was considering it. And we need to do away with birthright citizenship. I'll have more to say on that in a minute. So then you say, okay, this is a part of the Constitution. It was amended, 14th Amendment. It's part of the Constitution, clearly. How's the U.S. Supreme Court going to interpret it? Well, 1873, again, this is just 5 years after the 14th Amendment was written and ratified. Just 5 years later. Not long. The 1873 slaughterhouse cases, several, that's literally the name that's given to it. It's kind of several cases that were kind of combined. But the court interpreted the citizenship clause consistent with the legislative intent of the U.S. senators and U.S. House members. And it held that children born to ministers, consuls, and citizens or subjects of foreign states while in the U.S. are not citizens. Any children born to ministers, consuls, and citizens or subjects of foreign states while in the U.S. are not citizens. That's what it clearly said. Well, a further question is asked. Ponder this. Think in your mind. If one fulfills both conditions for citizenship, so you have two conditions. First condition, born or naturalized, right? Either you follow the naturalization rules if you're from a foreign nation and to come here, or you're born here, first condition. The second condition, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, giving your complete sole allegiance and loyalty to the United States and the Constitution. Well, let's say if one fulfills both conditions for citizenship, they're born here and also they claim to be subject completely to the jurisdiction of the U.S., does then that automatically make them a citizen of the U.S.? Does it automatically make them a citizen of the U.S.? The U.S. Supreme Court addressed that question in Elk v. Wilkins in 1884. Now, that's just 16 years after the 14th Amendment was ratified. Not long. So you think, yeah, it's pretty close. They should get this right. They did. They held that neither Indian tribes nor members of those tribes, no more than any other foreigners, can become U.S. citizens of their own will. There was a Native American Indian who claimed to have fulfilled both conditions. And he demanded to be recognized as a U.S. citizen because he said, I've done it. I've done both. On my own, you got to recognize my U.S. citizenship. The Supreme Court said, no, we don't have to because we're a sovereign nation. We're a sovereign nation. No one can become a citizen of the U.S. without the nation's consent. It's reciprocal, in other words. It's mutual. It has to be mutual. In other words, you can't come here unless we who are already here say yes. We're a sovereign nation. This is our house. You don't get just to come in, open the door, and have dinner at my table whenever you feel like it. No, this is our sovereign nation. That the nation has a right to accept whoever they choose, mutual or reciprocal consent is required to become a citizen of the United States. Now listen to this. In other words, no one can be made a citizen against his will, nor can anyone become a citizen without the consent of those who already constitute the body politic. It's the whole idea of national sovereignty, that no one can become a citizen of a nation without the nation's consent. You don't have sovereignty unless you have that. We can't have 8 billion people on the planet on their own will come here all at once and say, guess what? We did both. You have to accept us. No, we don't. That's what you'd have. if it's all of their own will to become a citizen of the U.S. Edward Erler, this is what he concluded, quote, "It is clear that crossing the border illegally demonstrates no allegiance whatsoever to the laws of the United States." Again, two conditions. First one, born or naturalized. Either born here or you follow the naturalization laws. And subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Complete and sole allegiance to the laws and constitution of the U.S. If you've come here illegally, you show right there you have not met the second condition. By the very fact that you came here illegally. So, simply being born within the borders of the United States to one of these illegal aliens should not make you a citizen of the United States. Victor Davis Hanson has pointed out that the word alien, for the ancient Greeks, that was a word they used, that says it's somebody who doesn't belong. They don't belong here. They're an alien. Christians are aliens and sojourners here on planet Earth. That's right. 1 Peter 2:11, our citizenship is in heaven. Philippians 3:20, we don't belong here technically. Right? Ultimately, our citizenship is heaven. But, you know, the political correctness of our day, you're not supposed to use the word alien, right? Just a migrant, I guess. So I ask the question then, why is birthright citizenship the law of the United States today? Why? Well, it's because of a wrongly decided U.S. Supreme Court case. 1898, have it here on the board, U.S. v. Wong Kim Ark. This is why it's important we have good people in the U.S. Supreme Court. Because if they make boneheaded decisions that are not correct, it has great ramifications for following generations. This court, basically 30 years, a generation later, you have a different mix of judges, justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. We're all one generation away from losing our liberties. They rejected the court's earlier interpretation of the citizenship clause. In this case, Wong's parents were Chinese. He was Chinese. His parents were subjects of the Emperor of China. At the time that they resided here in the U.S. And he was born to them. While they resided here in the U.S. But they were subjects of the Emperor of China. The court embraced birthright citizenship. They even cited Calvin's case, of all things. Talk about a bad decision. I want you to note that this is the same Supreme Court with this mix of judges that had this terrible decision on the citizenship clause in 1898 with U.S. v. Wong Kim Ark. It's the same court, the same mixture of justices that wrongly interpreted the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, that each guarantees equal protection under the laws of its citizens, okay? It was the Plessy v. Ferguson decision of 1896. What they did is they were allowing separate but equal. They were allowing racial segregation. To say blacks have their schools, whites have their schools, and that satisfies the Equal Protection Clause. The Southerners were segregating schools and other facilities, public government facilities. So the court wrongly sanctioned racism and called it satisfying the Equal Protection Clause. That was overturned wisely in Brown v. Board of Education, roughly 60 years later, in 1954, that integrated the schools. And by the way, it took federal troops. It was 101st Airborne Eisenhower sent down south. So under the early insurrection laws in America, just as a side note for you, the president can use federal troops to enforce federal law when local cities and states refuse to. We're going to run into this with Trump here shortly, because we have these sanctuary states and sanctuary cities that refuse to deal with illegal immigrants. They're refusing to enforce federal law. And Trump, just like Eisenhower, can bring in federal troops if he wants to enforce federal law to these local communities. So if the mayor of Denver wants to go to jail, he'll go to jail. Think about it a minute. So this court, 30 years after the 14th Amendment was written and ratified, messed up the Equal Protection Clause that legitimized racial segregation. And that was overturned rightly 60 years later in Brown v. Board of Education in 1954. They also got the Citizenship Clause wrong, in my mind, in the U.S. v. Wong Kim Ark, 1898, and that needs to be overturned as well, right? It needs to be overturned to get back to the 1873 slaughterhouse cases and the Elk v. Wilkins case and the legislative intent of the U.S. senators and representatives at the time. That birth alone will not suffice to become a citizen of the United States. Birthright citizenship goes back to a monarch, of all things, which we obviously do not have in the United States of America. Edward Eller, he notes this, quote, "Most countries have abandoned birthright citizenship. England did so in 1981 under the Iron Lady, Margaret Thatcher. they have a monarchy in name only. It's Parliament runs things in England. So England got rid of birthright citizenship in 1981. Ireland got rid of birthright citizenship in 2004, 20 years ago. That was the last of the original 15 European Union nations to give up birthright citizenship, 20 years ago. In the world of mass migrations, Erler says, most countries have recognized that the idea of a sovereign nation is incompatible with birthright citizenship. Unquote. Now, think about this. At America's founding, just as for ancient Israel, the problem of immigration was understood in terms of both prudence, in other words, wisdom, and morality, the cult, the religion. Who are you allowing to immigrate in? In ancient Israel, don't allow pagans to immigrate in. Don't have mixed marriages. Don't make treaties with them. Don't have mixed alliances and allegiances. Maintain the cult. Maintain the overall general religious devotion and worship of your people group, of your nation. And out of wisdom and morality, maintain it. And that's the same at America's founding. Out of wisdom and morality. And that's why America wanted immigrants from Europe at America's founding. They had a Christian background, they had habits that fit in with the culture of Western civilization in America. Now, they had other requirements where on health, typically in America, people would be tested. Do they have TB? Do you have some communicable disease that's serious, right? For our own safety here in the country, we've got to know who's coming in. On the health side as well, for disease, mental disability, people typically were turned away. They had mental disorders. We want people with skills that are not a burden, that are not going to overbear the welfare system and make us go bankrupt. We want people of a Christian background, the same cult. America's founding early on, they prevented prostitutes from immigrating in and becoming citizens, prevented criminals from coming in, those of unsavory character. It was wise, but also to maintain the civilization and culture. I got to say a little bit before we end today on the Federal Immigration Act of 1924 and the Federal Immigration Act of 1965. The Progressive Era, as you know, was the late 1800s on to today. In the late 1800s, we talked about it at the intro to our course, you're at the height of secularism. Remember that 200-year period, 1789 to 1989, the height of secularism. And it dominated the sciences. We talked about that. Whether it was Charles Darwin in biology or Lyell in geology, Pierre Laplace in astronomy, right? Secularism dominated, even in modern psychology, right? With Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung, with his occultism. But forms of paganism and secularism dominated. Well, what happened is evolutionary biology became social Darwinianism. And that was a part of the Third Reich with the Nazis, with the Aryan race they felt was a more evolved race, superior. I have a thick book in my library about the Darwinism of the Nazi regime. Well, it ended up dominating progressivism as well. The progressives hated the U.S. Constitution. Atheistic evolutionary theory entered immigration law in the United States. The Immigration Act of 1924 essentially ignored most asylum seekers, which the Founding Fathers had focused on, right? We knew most people came here for religious freedom, right? Think of the pilgrims. Asylum seekers, in a sense, been persecuted for their faith. Well, instead of focusing on these asylum seekers with social Darwinianism, they implemented rigid quotas to limit immigration from races that they deemed inferior. So they looked around the world and said, we think certain races are inferior than others. And they looked, because what you have is, there's no fixed thing, again, of human nature. We evolved from the slime. So therefore, what you have is that some people are closer to the monkeys than others in their mind. That's the way the social Darwinians look at various human groups. That's the way the Nazis looked, and they exterminated 6 million people on behalf of that. Well, that entered the Immigration Act of 1924. And they had rigid quotas to limit immigration from races that they deemed to be biologically inferior. And tragically, the Immigration Act of 1924 made it nearly impossible for Jews to find asylum in America during the 1930s when Hitler came to power in Germany. It's a sad note in our history. That during that period of time, the Jews had a hard time getting into the U.S. because we had these rigid quotas, because certain races were deemed inferior. In response to this history of racist immigration policy during the Progressive Era and the wrong understanding of America's founding, focusing on white immigrants from Europe, the Federal Immigration Act of 1965 replaced the national or group quotas with individual criteria, saying we're only going to look at individual criteria of people, but we're going to focus on immigrating non-Europeans. Remember, 1960s, we had the Cultural Revolution. And the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost made the last train for the coast. In the American Pie song, God and the Bible were castrated from American culture in the 1960s Cultural Revolution. Right? We began the course quoting C.S. Lewis. All of it began in Europe before coming to America in the 1960s Cultural Revolution. But they castrated God in the Bible and bid the geldings be fruitful. Victor Davis Hanson notes that Senator Ted Kennedy, U.S. Senator Ted Kennedy, led the effort to pass the Federal Immigration Act of 1965 to focus upon non-Europeans and say that America is too European. In other words, they were saying is America is too Christian. Remember the Beatles went east, where they became Hindu. So they rejected Western civilization and they focused on immigrating people from nations dominated by Hinduism, Buddhism, and Islam. That's what happened in the Federal Immigration Act of 1965. Even David Wells, that theologian, noted that the Immigration Act of 1965 changed America. Ted Kennedy literally said, we're too European. Now you think about that a minute. Again, civilization, what is it? The cultural characteristics of a people group. What is the culture? It's centered on the cult. Historically, cultus, culte in the Latin, the French, the overall devotion and worship of a people group. What is the religious devotion and worship of the people group? That determines its culture, determines its ethics of right and wrong, its legal system, how they view marriage, how they view everything else. Remember, Hinduism sees everything as one, ultimate one, reality. Buddhism, same thing. And when you couple the effects of the Federal Immigration Act of 1965 with the massive illegal immigration, it's all a recipe for national suicide. What they should have done is rejected the racist immigration policies of the progressive era and said, you know what, we're all created equal. That we are all endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. And then among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Natural equality before God, our Creator. So clearly declared in the Declaration of Independence. They should have overturned the U.S. v. Wong Kim Ark case of 1898. They should have re-embraced the wisdom and morality of the founding era that was articulated in the 1873 slaughterhouse cases, in the Elk v. Wilkins case of 1898. They should have rejected birthright citizenship. They should have said, you know, we need wisdom. Our nation is made for a moral and religious people, and that is of Christian background. The nations that are pagan have never lasted with true freedom. True freedom is found in God's laws. So William Blackstone said it clearly in his commentaries on the laws of England. Our happiness is coeval with what? God's laws. Coexistent with it. Life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, and that is God's law, is the law of liberty, James 1:25. But in addition, I'll end with this. And this is a proposal from Vivek Ramaswamy, in his book that came out this last year. He thinks as well we should do away with birthright citizenship. He's a son of immigrants from India. He is Hindu but claims it's a form of Hinduism, that there are different branches, and it's one branch he claims it's closest to Christianity. He suggests that because there's two conditions in the citizenship clause, consistent with the American founders. Born or naturalized, first condition, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. That the person gives their whole, complete allegiance as the second condition. Well, what are you giving your allegiance to? You need to pass a citizenship test. You need to know, what does the U.S. Constitution stand for? What's in the Bill of Rights? What do we stand for as a people when we have our conversation of what we value? Do you or do you not hate state-sponsored censorship of free speech? If you understand the U.S. Constitution and the First Amendment, it makes your blood boil when we have the federal government colluding with social media corporations to censor free speech of our citizenry. We're giving our sole allegiance to the U.S. Constitution and the laws of the land. So he would say, you know what? Let's require every natural-born person in the United States of America, or meet the first condition, they're naturally born here, like myself, to pass a citizenship test and take an oath of allegiance to the U.S. Constitution and the laws of the land when they register to vote. I like the idea. To enjoy all the privileges of citizenship. And there he discusses in his book the kind of the legal hurdles to kind of get through it. But he says, you know, voting is a privilege, not a right. You can lose your right to vote by committing a felony. So therefore, you say, well, if you didn't pass the citizenship test or you won't give the oath of allegiance, well, then we're not going to let you vote. But that's a way, then, of having us who were naturally born here fulfill the second condition. We have a citizenship test to really know what we stand for as citizens. The U.S. Constitution and the Declaration of Independence should be included because that's the preface to the U.S. Constitution, the ideals that the Constitution is seeking to preserve. But citizenship test is about our history, the basic history, and the Pilgrims and the Mayflower Compact and all of that stuff, in addition to the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, all of that stuff. I like the 1776 commission that President Trump had during his first term. Larry Arnn was involved in that, president of Hillsdale and others. But they need to resurrect that and get this before the 150th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence and get something like this set up, ready to roll. But that's, to me, would be good for our nation. But we need to do away with birthright citizenship in this country. I don't know if you have a case that goes up to the Supreme Court so they can overrule the U.S. v. Wong Kim Ark. Some would say Trump needs to just do away with it, period, by executive order, birthright citizenship, not recognize it under the federal agencies, under his authority, and then you'd immediately have some that would challenge it. It would immediately then go to the district appellate and up to the Supreme Court, and it could be challenged. Okay? So that's how you'd challenge it. Trump could force the issue in the executive side and his branch into the agencies and say, birthright, we're not going to recognize it. And obviously the liberals would go bonkers and then you end up with a court case all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And you'd let the Supreme Court right now, and I think they might do it. Overrule the U.S. v. Wong Kim Ark case, go back to the original understanding that's there with the 14th Amendment and was understood in the Elk v. Wilkins case and the 1873 slaughterhouse cases. So, that ends the first journey through Jerusalem. I wanted to discuss citizenship because that's kind of the capstone of what we found looking at the Mosaic Law and everything around Israel. Our history in America and Western civilization goes back all the way to Jerusalem. Lord willing, then, next time we meet, it'll be the beginning in January. And we're going to skip here third Saturday this month because of Christmas. But the first Saturday in January, we're going to start, Lord willing, our journey through Athens and look at the ancient Greek city-states and what the founders learned certain things. Some have said one of the things was what not to do, as well as the cult. You get the wrong cult, the paganism too can mess things up and create great problems. But They learned certain things about self-government and the polis from the ancient Greek city-states. So Lord willing, that's where we'll pick up next time we meet.